Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Election Day is a week from Tuesday. Throughout the month of October, Smart Talk has been discussing issues and other topics with the candidates on the ballot in the WITF listening area. Today, we're joined by incumbent Republican Congressman Scott Perry, who is running to represent the newly configured 10th Congressional District that encompasses all of Dauphin County and portions of Cumberland and York counties, including the cities of Harrisburg and York and the borough of Carlisle. Congressman Perry, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me. Thanks for the opportunity.
First question always is, why are you running again?
Well, because I think that there's plenty of work to be done. We've done a pretty good job. If you look at what's happened in the last couple years, employment's up, wages are up, opportunities up, freedoms up. The embassy is located in the capital of Israel, which is Jerusalem. Tax cuts are helping individual families and businesses. We're out of the Iran nuclear deal. I mean, if we want to keep on that track, those are the things that I've been working on, and those are the things that I want to keep on working on.
When you said freedom is up, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, as regulation stifles both individuals and businesses, and we've been working not only in Congress passing a record number of congressional review acts, but certainly the administration as well. Anytime those regulations, which were burdening both individuals and businesses and helping to cause what was a very tepid, oftentimes below 2% growth economy, anytime that happens, that restricts your freedom. So, whether you're in the banking business or whether you're in, the construction business, that makes a big difference for, like I said, both individuals and businesses. And that's what you're seeing is the unleashing of our free market economy. And when freedom's up, then opportunity's up. Right now, we have many more jobs than we have people seeking jobs. And when you're in that circumstance, it drives wages up, and also it drives opportunity up. So if you have a job now that you don't want because you don't like it, you have the opportunity to go get another job, and more likely than not, make more money at the new job. Or if you don't have a job at all, certainly you can go get a job. I mean, if you can show up with a good attitude on time these days, you can get a job. And that equals economic freedom and just general freedom for citizens. So I think that's something that is easily and too often overlooked, but it's really, really important.
What challenges and issues would you identify, though, as still the most significant that the nation faces?
Well, I think one of the most significant challenges we face is certainly border security and so far our inability to grapple with immigration on a large scale and deal with that. And we worked on that. I was privy and privileged to be a part of that. We got 195 votes. It generally takes about 218 to pass. We are 20 votes away. I urged our leadership. I urged the speaker. Let's go right back to the table. I think everybody could give a little bit and get those other 20 votes and pass something through the House. We did not do that, and I think that that is very lamentable. And I think that we really need to get back on that. And of course, obviously, healthcare, Obamacare is still in place. Prices are too high. People don't have the access and the freedom they want with that. We came within one vote of that in the Senate, and I urged our colleagues to get back to the table on that. And I understand if nothing changed in the Senate, that they were, reluctant to do that. But it looks like there's going to be a great opportunity moving forward after November 6th to get back to the table on that. And because of the cost and availability and some of the other stories that are being told, half the story, I absolutely think we need to get back to health care reform because it affects every single citizen in the country.
What do you mean half the story?
Well, when they say, well, you voted, if you're a Republican, you voted against pre-existing conditions, acting like the only way to deal with pre-existing conditions was through Obamacare or the ACA. As you know, and as everybody knows, there are multiple solutions to every single problem. That was not the only solution. That was a solution that didn't live up to any of the expectations that were surrounding it regarding cost or availability. You're going to save you money. and you're going to be able to keep your plan and keep your doctor. And none of those things happened. Astronomical costs, and you're not able to keep your plans or your doctors. So that's one side of the story. And they're saying, well, if you voted to repeal the ACA, you voted against pre-existing conditions. Of course, leaving out the whole other side of the story, where many, including myself, fought vociferously to make sure that pre-existing conditions were included and insurance companies could not deny individuals coverage for pre-existing conditions. And we had a plan for that, and we passed that plan in the House. And like I said, it fell one vote short in the Senate. But that's the other half of the story that, of course, nobody's seeing when they watch TV or when they go to their mailbox every day. They only hear half the story.
Well, looking at it one issue at a time, I mean, when you do vote more than three dozen times to repeal Obamacare, pre-existing conditions are part of that, covering pre-existing conditions. So that is the story. Are you referring?
But Scott, that's half the story.
Okay,
one.
Well, let me get
and
on to the other.
Number two. All those times weren't voting to repeal Obamacare completely. It might have been components of Obamacare. So I just have to correct the record. That's disingenuous, and it only informs a part of the story.
Well, are you referring to the insuring coverage for patients with pre-existing conditions bill that was in the Senate?
Yeah, well, the American Health Care Act.
Okay, American Health Care Act, that was one thing. But the insuring coverage for patients with pre-existing conditions, I saw an analysis of this, said that there are large loopholes in it, that the bill says that everyone with a pre-existing condition must be able to get insurance, but it doesn't say the pre-existing condition must be covered. That's a big loophole.
That is a big loophole, but I would also say this. Look, nothing is perfect, and we continue to work towards a more perfect circumstance for everybody. But when we started on this odyssey, 30 million Americans were uninsured, were uncovered with any coverage at all. And now post-Obamacare, with all the increases in cost, with all the turmoil, with all the uncertainty, people losing their plans, all those things, we still have 30 million Americans without coverage. What did it fix?
So just so we can clarify for voters right now, you would not vote to repeal Obamacare if there wasn't something in place that covered pre-existing conditions?
Whatever replaces the ACA has to cover pre-existing conditions.
All right. So let's move on to some other issues.
Sure.
Congressman, you're part of the Freedom Caucus. You're one of the most conservative members of Congress. The Freedom Caucus is made up of conservative House members. How would you describe the Freedom Caucus, and why are you part of it?
The Freedom Caucus speaks for the people in America that feel that no one's listening to their voice, number one. That's the mission of the Freedom Caucus, and there are two rules to be in the Freedom Caucus. Rule number one, you must be willing to vote with your constituents and against your party's leadership when your party's leadership demands that you do otherwise. So that's rule number one. We stick with the people that elected us. Rule number two, you must be willing to negotiate to a point where you can vote for something. So you can't just be a no vote because it's not perfect. Those are the two rules to be in Freedom Caucus. Quite honestly, I look around and I wonder why everybody's not in the Freedom Caucus. We don't go to take orders from leadership. We go to take orders from our constituents and vote on, for their best interest. And like I said, you have to be willing to come to a compromise at some point. There are 435 members of Congress, and you can't get everything your way. And in that context, one of the things I'm proud of is that over the course of this two-year session, I've been able to pass 10 bipartisan pieces of legislation, either standalone or amendments. That's Republicans and Democrats agreeing on the things we agree on and getting something accomplished.
But when you use the word compromise, and that has been the criticism of the Freedom Caucus, that the Freedom Caucus has been called obstructionist, even by some members of your own party.
Scott,
they say, they say you're not willing to compromise.
Yeah, they say that because we don't do what they tell us to do. Remember, it's the leadership in our party that says those things about us. They would prefer that we go in a room, they say, this is how we need you to vote, and we say, well, look, our constituents don't support that. Well, that's too bad. We need you to vote this way because we need to pass this. That's what they want. And when you don't do that, of course they're going to criticize you. Of course they are. We don't stand for them. We stand for the people that elected us.
a couple questions there, Congressman. Can you give an example or examples of where you've reached across the aisle and acted in a bipartisan fashion?
Yeah. The first bill I passed was a bipartisan bill with a member from New York City named Grace Meng, a Democrat from New York. And what we found together was that during the Benghazi investigation, that the Secretary of State did not have the authority to fire people that she found accountable in the things that happened and in the irresponsible decisions that were made in her department. And so we teamed up together to make sure that there was no ambiguity, that these people that were found to be accountable could be held accountable. That was the first bill that I was able to get passed, and of course it was signed into law by President Obama. And like I said, I passed 10 just this session. One, the DHS SAGE Act, which we found out that the Department of Homeland Security, a component of that, the Federal Protective Service, had more vehicles than they had employees, and that the bulk of the vehicles, the bulk of the mileage on those vehicles was put on going from work to home as opposed to at work. We asked the department to change their process so that it was more efficient and more accountable. They refused to. I teamed up with a whole host of Democrat colleagues. We offered the legislation to require the Department of Homeland Security Federal Protective Service to comply with fleet regulations commensurate with other federal government agencies and save the taxpayer millions of dollars. Mm.
And the other part of that question that I had is, you said that what you're dedicated to, members of the Freedom Caucus, is doing what your constituents sent you there, or representing the wishes of your constituents. You know, I've always been curious, not just you, but any member of Congress, how do you know what your constituents, other than an election, how do you know what your constituents want?
Well, it's by constant conversation. I mean, I don't live in Washington, D.C., I don't stay there except for session time. So other than the times that we're in session, I'm at home in the district. I'm at the grocery store. I'm at the gas station. I'm at community events. I'm meeting with constituents on a regular basis in the office, at their places of business. And we have conversations about what's important to them, what's on their mind, and what they want to see done about it. Sure, I have to make a decision on bills that come to the floor that they might not have talked about, but generally speaking, I feel like I listen to their concerns, and you know this. I mean, there are 720,000 of your bosses in a congressional district. You know, some of your bosses aren't going to be happy with the decision because that would require every single one of your bosses to agree. And of course, we don't agree on everything. So you have to look at the circumstance and say, what would the most of the people in the district do if they had the information that I have, if they had the decision in front of us, that in front of me that I have. And that's how I try and judge that.
Congressman, if you are able to win this election and represent the new 10th district, this is a different district. All of Dauphin County, parts of York County, and parts of Cumberland County as well. How do you know what that new district wants?
Well, again, I'm in the district. I mean, I've lived here since 1969, and traveled all parts of this district, from all of Dauphin County, all of York County, certainly all of Cumberland County. And I live here. I do commerce here. I struggle with the same things. My family struggles with the same things that people here do. I hear the local news, and we eat our meals in local restaurants. We buy gas at the local gas station, and we shop at the local stores, and we talk to people right here. So generally speaking, most of us want a lot of the same things. Yes, there are some subtleties here and there, but we want safe. We want our communities to be safe. We support our law enforcement. We want our government to be effective and efficient. We understand that we have to pay taxes, and we all want to do our part. But we don't want the taxes that we spend or send in. We don't want that to be squandered. We want our infrastructure to be 21st century. We want our roads to be fixed. We want broadband cable. We want access to water, sewer, and gas, telephone. We want all those things. We want access to adequate and effective and reasonably cost and affordably cost health care. I mean, these are perennial things, whether you live in northern Dauphin County, western Cumberland County, southern York County, or anywhere in between, whether you live on a farm, whether you live in the suburbs, or whether you live right downtown. Most people want all this access and to the same things. And so it's just a matter of having a conversation about how we do that.
Well, and that's the big question and how people will decide their votes. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. We're speaking with Congressman Scott Perry. He is running for re-election in a newly configured 10th congressional district that encompasses all of Dauphin County and portions of Cumberland and York counties. Congressman, just before the break, we were talking about the newly configured district. The district now includes Harrisburg, York, and Carlisle, two cities and a fairly large borough. These two cities have some of the same problems that other urban areas across the country do. Poverty is one of those issues. What can be done to help people get out of poverty?
One of the greatest things to help people get out of poverty is a growing economy where they have opportunity and where they have the freedom of choice. Where, you know, they can move up through the workforce. You can start out even if you don't have many skills. Scott, I was a guy who started out as a young man with the only skill I had, which was that I could show up on time with a good attitude. But you can quickly move up, especially in this economy. There are employers that are just reaching out every single day for people that will do that. They will train them. And those employees can prosper. That's one of the biggest things we can do, is create the conditions for great economic activity so people have those options. If you have a job now that you think you could be making more money at, or that you don't really like the job, maybe the tenants of the job, this is an economy where you can leave that job almost knowing with 100% certainty that you can get another job that very same day. That's one of the greatest things that we can do, because at that point, government isn't deciding what's best for individuals. Individuals are deciding what's best for them and what best fits into their lifestyle. You know, lifestyles are very different. If you're a single mom and you're dealing with your children and trying to get them to school and to soccer practice and you know, maybe working from home best suits you, that's very different than somebody that wants to travel. And, you know, right now there's a huge shortage of truck drivers, whether it's over the road or whether it's local delivery. I mean, those opportunities now exist at record levels. And I think, you know, from a poverty standpoint, whether it's in the city, and by the way, it's other places, not just in the city. We have some of our local towns, especially in the newly configured 10th district, that struggle with some of these issues from a standpoint of urban and suburban blight, and where there's no renters, there's nothing but renters in the town. Nobody owns the homes anymore, and then no one takes care of them. And those are issues that involve poverty as well, and that require very unique solutions where government can be a good partner.
You want to talk about so many issues, Congressman, but in the short amount of time, I'm trying to touch on as many as we can. Many people, especially if they didn't live in your prior district, actually the district you represent now, but will be the new district, maybe they're not as familiar with Scott Perry as they could be. What they're learning is through the TV commercials. I have to admit that I've seen more pictures of Nancy Pelosi in the past month than I've seen of my own wife. These spots are pounding away at your opponent for being a liberal. He says he doesn't know Pelosi, and that and we're talking about George Scott, Democrat. He also says he wouldn't support Nancy Pelosi if Democrats were to take control of the House as the Speaker of the House again. Tell him about those commercials. I mean, because a lot of people say they're misleading. Some will come out and say there's outright lies there.
Well, this is what we do know. Nancy Pelosi and the DCCC sent my opponent over $250,000, put it right into his bank account for running ads against me on TV that are disingenuous. Now, he may say he doesn't know her, but I will tell you this, Scott, when somebody sends somebody over $250,000, I suspect he's going to get to know her and she's going to want something for her $250,000. While he has said that he's inclined not to support Ms. Pelosi, he has not said who he will support. I'm a person who puts it right out there. Some people disagree with you know, my position on an issue, or in this case, my position on the speaker. But they can know going into the election, they will know who I would be voting for speaker under the current circumstances. We don't know that about our opponent, but we do know that he's taken over $250,000 from her. And so I think it's important for voters to realize that and wonder, what would they do if somebody gave them $250,000?
Well, if along that the same lines, then he runs a commercial, George Scott runs a commercial saying that you accepted over $100,000 from the insurance industry, and that they have some control over how you would vote or do vote when it comes to health care.
Right. Well, I would say this. First of all, I'm one of the least raising money members of Congress, and you can go back over the years. We don't raise much money. My opponent has raised he raised probably more in one quarter than I have in almost my entire congressional time. So, and if he's talking about, you know, he doesn't take corporate PAC donations, but he takes union PAC donations, and of course, three times the rate that I've taken donations. So, while, you know, he can complain about campaign finances and that they might influence votes, I think you have to ask yourself how his votes are going to be influenced when he's taking three times the amount of money that the current representative is taking.
And again, Congressman, we only have a short amount of time, so I'm going to try to get onto as many issues as I can. Guns and school safety.
Yeah.
We know that this country has a real problem with a number of school shootings and other shootings that have occurred. Mass shootings occurred at places where a lot of people gather. You know, there are a lot of people after those incidents. We'll talk about what we have to do more when it comes to making guns available. Universal background checks, for one. What do you advocate as far as keeping guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them?
Well, first of all, we want solutions that are effective, solutions that work, not just solutions that are taken in a knee-jerk fashion that are emotional in the heart and the heat of the moment, which is unfortunately what I think my opponent is advocating for. It's a very delicate balance with our constitutional rights, which are, you know, they're right there in the Constitution, and of course our desire for safety. And what I've been privileged to do is meet with many of the local school superintendents who tell a very different story, where we often think intuitively what the answer is. When you talk to the people that are making the decisions, that are dealing with the problem right up front, you hear there's a variety of solutions. And what they have told me is there's a, you know, it's different from school to school, from district to district, what way they think will help and what they think will solve the problem. In particular, I was surprised to find out that many of them want resources for particular counselors, not your average guidance counselor, but someone who will talk with the students, who the students feel comfortable with, because students don't want to tell on their friends. Even if they're not necessarily their friends, but somebody they're affiliated or associated with in school, they don't want that stigma. Even if they think that there's a problem or there might be a danger there, they're reluctant to talk about it. But they will talk to a counselor, a specific counselor that is kind of like a friend, but also an adult figure in the school. So that's part of the equation that I think people are unaware of, and that comes directly from the people that are managing the issue. Some superintendents ask for resources to help them harden their schools and their entry points because they're older buildings and they don't comport with the new requirements for school safety. And yet others still want resources for resource officers in their schools. And again, those things are decided at the local level by the people in the community. And it seems to me that the one size federal government, the one size fits all across the country, you know, it might work in Los Angeles or Las Vegas, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's gonna work, you know, in Central Dauphin School District or something like that. So that's kind of how I look at it. I think there is a mental health component where we can do a little better. There are some bills moving through the Congress, or have been, that I've been kind of keeping an eye on to see where they go and what they do. But we got to be careful with that as too, because many involved in the mental health industry will tell you that, if we can call it an industry, maybe field is a better way of putting it. Many will tell you that even though there are people that are affected with mental health issues, they're not dangerous. And so you don't want to cast everybody with a mental health issue as someone who is dangerous and somebody's going to, you know, use a firearm to harm their friends, their neighbors, their school, what have you. But there is a component there. There are certainly component where there are people with mental health issues that should not have access to a firearm. The question is how do you best do that and deal with that without abridging everybody else's constitutional rights?
And I wish we had more time to discuss that issue, but you brought up Las Vegas, and I do have to bring this up. You have gotten a lot of national attention for some of your appearances on television shows, national cable networks. One, you said that the Las Vegas shooting last year was ISIS-related. Now, the FBI and the police in Las Vegas say there's no evidence of that. Do you stick by that?
Here's what I said. I said I had credible evidence. I received a briefing by the intelligence community in Washington, D.C., in the Secure Compartmentalized Information Facility, otherwise known as SCIF, where you receive classified information, a briefing that is very different than the one that you're seeing on television. And I felt compelled to let people know and to kind of urge that information out there, because based on that briefing, I think that there may be Americans that are in danger, and we haven't gotten to the bottom of the subject yet. And I will remind everybody, the FBI investigation still continues.
But forgive me for the description, but this is, you know, there have been some who have described that as a crazy conspiracy theory.
Well, they can describe it that way, but they haven't gotten the briefing, and maybe they don't have a top secret security clearance, which I do. And I'm just telling you that I got a briefing that doesn't comport with the briefing that you're getting on TV from news outlets.
Congressman, we're almost out of time. I always like to allow our candidates to leave a message with voters. What would that be?
Well, the message is this. I come from right here. I have lived and struggled with the same things that everybody else in this district has as an individual, as a business person, and that is my background. And since I come from right here and live the same life and struggle the same struggles that everybody else does, that most people do, I feel like I've been an outstanding representative and have been there to listen to people. Not that we all don't always agree on everything, but I have been open every single time to listen to all constituents and all viewpoints, and have had an open mind, and literally have had my mind changed on occasion by listening to those constituents, and have offered legislation in that regard on things that that I would have probably never believed that I would have, such as the Charlotte's Medical Web Access Act, which is a form of medical marijuana, because it's important to families that are trying to treat their family members that have seizure disorders, and the government stands in the way of that. So from that standpoint, I am a hardworking individual that has been right out front. You know where I stand on issues, and I'm respectful for every single person. I'm a person who believes in service and in servant leadership, which means that I understand who my boss is. It's the 720 or so thousand constituents in any congressional district, and I'd be privileged to have your consideration for your vote, on November 6th.
Congressman Scott Perry, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, sir. Have a great day.
WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lair. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. I can tell you that already after the conversation with Congressman Perry, I'm hearing from voters out there, some voters who, for the most part, don't agree with Congressman Perry. And they're not very happy about what they've heard. They actually are not interested in hearing a whole lot about what the opposing side has to hear today, because they have their minds made up when it comes to this. But the question is, and it's a symptom of what we see in this country right now, why is everyone so angry? At least it feels that way, especially when it comes to talking about politics and issues where there are disagreements. You don't have to look far to find it on social media, TV newscasts, in restaurants, and other public gatherings. But one of the big differences is that sometimes this anger turns violent. We're going to be talking about why the country is so angry right now, especially when it comes to politics. Joining us on today's program, Darcy Meyer is co-chair of the Better Angels Alliance of Gettysburg. Carr Thompson is a Democrat. He's a member of the group as well. Republican Chad Colley, also a member of that group. And Lene Amberstam, Ampersand. See, now you told me I would pronounce it correctly, and I screwed it up. Lene Ampersand, who is a clinical program manager for psychiatry at the Outpatient Psychiatry Clinic at Penn State's Milton S. Hershey Medical Center. I want to thank all of you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
All right, so, Lene, I am going to start with you. Why is everyone so angry today?
Well, and if I can take a step back, if I could, and say that, you know, our four baseline, our natural emotions is being happy, being sad, being scared, and being mad. And so anger does not always equal being mad. There's a lot of times the underlining root of our anger could be someone who's scared or someone who's sad. And so when you're exposed to events and situations that are going on in the world today, you know, that it could increase our hopelessness, it can increase our fear, and then ultimately that would increase that passionate anger that we have.
But there has to be something that is setting it off. I mean, I think back to, and I thought a lot about this after last Saturday and the shooting at the synagogue in Pittsburgh. You know, I lived through the 60s. I saw, you know, violence in the streets, riots, assassinations, bombings, and a lot of it had political overtones. At that time, I didn't think I'd ever see that kind of division again in this country. Mm-hmm. But here we are. We are seeing maybe not the exact same kind, but we are seeing division and a tribalism that is out there. Why? What's different?
Well, and a lot of times our experiences equal our beliefs. And so things that we experience and we see and things going on with politics and different topics, whatever that triggers in us can also trigger our feelings and our emotions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so go a little further here. What are people seeing that trigger those emotions?
They're seeing a lot of fighting back and forth amongst the political parties. They're seeing individuals taking their own feeling and emotions and acting out on different races, different cultures. So a lot of things, they're seeing a lack of control from different individuals that could be taken out of context.
When you say taken out of context, in what way? I mean, many people are sure that they have the context that they need to justify the emotions that they have.
Right. And a lot of people feel, I have a right to do this to this person, or I have a right to say this or stand up for my own beliefs. And a lot of times it's crossing lines that are getting people angry and crossing boundaries that cause a lot more division than needed.
I use the word tribalism, mm-hmm. and that seems to be a characteristic of what we have. We've backed into our own corners. If I could use a boxing analogy, we've boxed in, we're into our own corners now, and we're not willing to come out. We're not willing to say, you know what, I respect my opponent or my opponent politically, that, you know, my opponent may have some legitimate points. They're all wrong. They're vilified. They're evil. They're demonized. That's changed in just the last decade or so.
Right. And there has to be some type of common ground. No matter what side you're on, each side is saying they're for the people or they're doing this for the advancement to make everything better. And so that's where we have to come to some agreement. What is our common ground area that we really are doing for everyone? But everybody's opinion on what those things are different.
All right. But no one seems to be willing to come to that common ground right now. So how do you change that?
Right. And a lot of times, you know, we have to get back to our critical thinking skills. Everybody takes one part of the, you know, of the story and really just really being willing to explore both sides of the story to try to come to an agreement and understanding of what's really going on. But a lot of times that doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen very often. I mean, I'm going to use today's show as an example in that there were many, many people who were calling in or sending emails that they disagreed with Congressman Perry. And, you know, as the program was 5 minutes into the program, I'm seeing responses from listeners who disagree with the congressman who want, why aren't you asking this? Why aren't you asking that? You know, the idea of what we're trying to do is put information out there that voters can make a decision, but people don't want to hear it. so many people don't want to hear what they disagree with. Now, I sound like I'm making speeches here, but I think it's a big part. It's a big part of it. So, all right, let's talk with Darcy Meyer, who is co-chair of the Better Angels Alliance of Gettysburg. First of all, and we're going to talk about where your name comes from, the Better Angels, in just a moment. But tell me about your organization. Why did you? What do you stand for? What are you trying to do? And why do you see a need for it?
Well, first of all, you were talking about people being polarized and not interested in talking across the lines. And actually, what I found in my experience is that if you sit down and talk to people, and they are interested in finding out about the other side. So that's what Better Angels does. We bring people together, reds and blues together in the same room. We teach them how to listen to each other. We teach them how to talk to each other. We teach them how to express themselves without a lot of anger, without creating more rancor. That's really what Better Angels is. It's a national organization. We are now about 5,000 strong and growing every day. And really,
and we started from three less than 2 years ago.
Okay, well, I will say this, that that growth is commendable, but we have 300 million Americans. Maybe 100 million of them are divided. I don't know how. That's my figure. I'm just throwing that out there. 5,000 is a long way to go.
It is a long way to go until you realize how many local people there are, how many towns and communities there are across the nation that actually have small groups. I mean, we joined Better Angels, but we started as just a small local group in Gettysburg. People who were interested in getting together and talking, and talking about the issues in a way that did not create anger.
Okay, you were able to get people together. And we have a Republican and we have a Democrat here, and I wasn't pointing to either way. You know, I know which party you belong to. Just to let our listeners know, I pointed to the Democrat as a Republican and the Republican as a Democrat. So, anyway, that, you know, how, getting those people to take that step. You know, what I would compare it to is when someone has an addiction problem, you always hear that the first step is admitting you have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get people to admit they have a problem. They're right. Don't tell me I'm wrong. Don't tell me I can improve, and or the other side has anything to say that I'm interested in, because, damn it, I'm right.
Okay, well, I'll start from my story then.
Okay.
I am a Democrat, pretty staunchly blue, always voted Democrat, never voted for a Republican in my life. Carr invited me to this group.
And Carr is a Democrat.
Carr is a Democrat. Just to come into the room and sit down. And when I came in and sat down and actually listened to what other people had to say, who I know I disagreed with politically, I was amazed at the human side. And that's really...
You mean actually that Carr was a human?
No, that Chad was a
Chad,
human.
Chad, who is the Republican, you were amazed that he is a human.
I was actually, yes. When, you know, I guess one of the things that I realized is that, honestly, all people have the same goals. We all want to be happy. We all want security. We all want success in our families. We all basically want, it's how we approach it, how we get to those things that are different. But if we realize that we all really do have the same goals and do have a sense of compassion for other people, then we have a place to start from. And I think that's what we're forgetting in our polarized society today, is that we don't realize that the other people really do have the same feelings that we do.
Have you voted for a Republican since?
We just started the group before the election,
okay,
so
well,
this is my first opportunity.
Do you plan to vote for a Republican?
No.
Why?
Because I believe that the Democrats have good ideas that are for the good of our country, and I don't, I have not changed my mind on any of the candidates yet.
Okay, so let me just push back on that. You say that Democrats have good ideas. You have not heard ideas that you agree with, in so many words, with Republicans. Then how do you, okay, obviously you're not sitting here calling Chad, who is a Republican, you know, that he's evil or that he's dumb. Not that I know of, anyway.
No.
We haven't done that so far. But that seems to be that it's personal, that it is much more the enemy, that Chad is the enemy because he doesn't have the same political beliefs that you have. Now, Carr, you want to jump in.
I want to jump in.
Carr
yes.
is a Democrat, by the way.
I am a moderator for Better Angels. I'm a trained moderator.
Okay.
To be a trained moderator of Better Angels, at the end, you have to be at, they have a 5 levels of depolarization. The lowest level is they are enemies. Hurt our country. Highest level is, although I continue convictions, have legitimate points, need to be heard for the good of our country. I am willing to, because I know Darcy and Chad, and I would say of Chad what John McCain said of Obama. He is a good man with whom I happen to agree. I know that they feel the same way. Darcy believes that Republicans have legitimate issues that need taken into account, and I know that Chad feels the same way.
Chad, I'm going to go ahead, Chad. What were you going to say?
Yep. I was just going to interject by saying that it's been a pleasure to know Democrats in my community.
And, you know, this sounds like it's like someone you're getting to know from a foreign country.
Right, and that's the whole point. You were referring to the dynamics earlier of people getting into conversations, and we've seen that. We had a red-blue workshop with Better Angels a couple of months ago, and it was strange and almost comical because you have two people sitting there just waiting to hear what the other has to say, but also wanting to interject all the time. And so it's interesting to sit there and watch people who have to listen to the other side and not speak. These workshops are struggling. It's really hard. And we get into this dynamic.
Can I interrupt for just one second?
Sure.
What's really hard?
Well, it's hard for people to step outside their box, you know, their political box, their little bubble. Their clique, their tribe, as you mm-hmm. mentioned earlier. And we've got to this dynamic where we have this mindset where I'm not going to give them because they're going to take the mile. And what we've found is that when you break arguments down, and we're talking about non-legislative, and that's important too. We're not taking legislative steps down to under one another better. And when you do that, you can find out what people's fears are. A friend of mine, we were talking a little while ago on the way in, and a friend of mine quoted Yoda from Star Wars. She said, you know, fear leads to anger, anger leads to hate, and hate leads to suffering. And so what we have found is that when people sit down together, it's strange, it's awkward, but you begin to realize, wait, they're on some things. Mm-hmm. But you have to take the time to have those conversations to get through all that.
You know, Chad, something you also said, now you put it as you have to listen, okay? But just an observation from someone who listens on a daily basis is we don't listen. We don't listen to the other side, disagree with. There are a couple things going on. One, we're thinking about how we're going to respond to it rather than listening to what that person has to say. And it just is, we don't want to listen to it because we're also, not only the response, but the response being that why you're wrong. Everything has turned into a debate rather than a conversation.
Absolutely.
Can I go again? The Better Angels does at this point, and we're developing other, we do two types of workshops. One, the first type that he mentioned is a red, brings together equal numbers of red and blue voters to work with a couple of trained moderators. The other is a skills workshop. The skills workshop teaches people how to listen to people on the side and then to speak in a way that people on the other are likely to listen to them. And part of the steps, without giving too many details, but the first listening, you feed back to the other person what he or she has said to make sure you've gotten it right.
Mm. I want to say something, too. Chad has taught me a lot about listening, and one of the things he's taught me is about trigger words. And one of the reasons why we have a hard time listening is because there's certain that Democrats use and certain words that Republicans trigger the other side and just automatically
get
you.
Well, for example,
Chad, help me.
Spread the wealth.
Okay, so that's a Republican.
Yeah.
Okay. Common ground. Yeah. That common ground word, which I had no idea that when I say that, I'm actually sending a message to the Republican that something that they're going to get angry about.
Okay, I was wrong. Spread wealth is not Republican, right?
No, spread the wealth is
Democrat. Okay. Yeah. But common ground, which, but those two words side by side, most people would say, yes, that's the answer.
Exactly.
But it's a trigger word.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Okay. All right. So, yeah.
And we were talking about that earlier, that people, a lot of times, their anger on a scale of 0 to 10, they could get angry, go to that without thinking about it, and it blacks out. So, when you hear a trigger word, they're already at 10, and there's not that opportunity to intercede or to listen or to do any rising or calming down when a person goes from 0 to 10, in less than a second. So,
and we only have like 3 minutes left, and we could do this a whole lot longer. I can tell you that, and we need to. But the current president, many people will blame President Trump for the anger we have in this country. He said before Trump, but the president has probably, what am I saying, probably, he has ratcheted up. And how much do you, and Chad and Carr, I'm going to ask, do you put, Chad,
I think there are
as
a, lot
a Republican?
Of, yeah, I think there are a lot of things to blame. I think his rhetoric could tone down a little bit. But as you point out, the anger and the division in this country has been here way far longer than President Trump hasn't created a lot of that. It's been here. And I think he has a great opportunity to help to a greater peace in this country, as we all do. As you'd mentioned before, better angels comes from Abraham Lincoln's words in the first. Yeah,
can I read this? Because this almost brings tears to my eyes. Yeah. We are not enemies, friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have been strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic words of memory will yet swell the course of the union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. That was Abraham Lincoln, his first inauguration in 1861. I have to admit that his optimism, I don't see it yet. That is, he says, as surely we will. Mm-hmm. Are you optimistic?
Optimistic that we can have greater peace. I don't achieve perfection. We never will, but we can sure seek to find that. And it comes back to what you had mentioned earlier with listening. A wise man once told me, there's a reason God gave us two ears and one mouth, and if we use those proportionally, we'll be a lot better off.
I would make the comment that I lived through the 60s, and I lived through an earlier era than you did. And we have gotten here one step at a time. My wife likes to recite a children's poem, little drops of water, little grains of sand. Drops of grains of sand have been piling up and getting us to where we are. And actually, I blame Trump more than Chad does. But I also agree it did not start with him. And it's not because of one side, but little drops of water and little grains of sand will get us out of where we are.
Darcy, 30 seconds. I know this is a question to answer in 30 seconds, but if you could leave advice with people today, what would it be? Maybe advice is not the right word, just a message you'd leave with people.
That we need to learn to communicate, obviously, and we need to approach each other with curiosity, instead of an attitude of listening for those trigger words, but really trying to figure out, where do you come from? What is your background? How did you get to where you are today?
I want to thank our guests for being with us today. We're going to have to do this again because obviously this is not something that's going to go away after next Tuesday. Darcy Meyer, Carr Thompson, and Chad Colley, all with Better Angels Alliance of Gettysburg. Lene Amisand, who is a clinical program manager for psychiatry at the Penn State's Milton S. Hershey Medical Center. Tomorrow we have our last candidate on the program. We also talk about democracy.